first talk to Kyle?
Yes, Kyle on this.
Quando tocca la tangente interna è tutto.
Ok.
Vedete, quello
che dovevo dire. Allora esce il sunset.
E poi c'è tutto il mondo. Poi c'è una frangetta alla fine che è l'egresso.
Provo a vedere qua.
Vedendo di riportarlo, la soggetta al cambio.
Non lo so. Posso informarmi se sento qualcosa? Magari provo a sentire Peter, dopo comunque un po' alla fine vado a campo.
Io
è una discussione un po' troppo. Un po' troppo
sociopolitica.
Infatti.
Non è un segno fisico estremo.
Ah, per quello.
Se parlo di Quark, io ho decennato di farmi trovare.
Più che altro è un po'... Sto vedendo,
sto morale.
Sto, vabbè, orca di troppo. Perché seguirò tipo salti, non so salti.
Con me che del tizio che ha parlato molto, cosa ti dà uccidere? Oh,
che aspetta. Io non ho capito il primo.
Molto diversi e ti parlano...
Quindi vediamo, ne seguo ancora un paio, poi vedo perché. Vabbè, volevo vedere questo qua, Dark Matter. Il primo pomeriggio 1.45, poi fai conto che questi qua non li seguono neanche. Tu lo fisso qua, no? E invece avevo qua per tutto il tempo. Perché... tutto mi sta facendo. Infatti per questo dico. Ho ancora una possibilità a questo. Solo che mi sono veramente preso male io. Sto preparando tutto questo. Ora è tanto. E quindi sono un ben po'.
Ce
l'ho. Buon
I need a break. If I saw you after the... Thanks.
Do you have one for
Does it look good? No, I've got it. I've got it.
All right. We will get underway. For the second session of the meeting, our first speaker is
Okay, so good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope your trip here was smoother than mine. So I'm going to talk about the... I'm going to talk about particle physics. It's always a difficult subject to try to give a feel for the field while also being sort of specific, so I'll do my best to balance those. So in terms of the outline, I'm going to just give a brief introduction to particle physics so you have some motivation for the physics of what we're doing. I'm going to talk about the progress that we've made in terms of statistical modeling of the data, the developments that we've made in terms of how we do our statistical tests, and then I'll try to end with a sort of review of the current challenges and open questions that we face. Perhaps one of the first points of progress that we've made, I think, is the fact that we actually distinguish these two steps. Think about the modeling of the data as one thing, and then think about the statistical tests that we apply to that model of the data as a separate step. I think in our past, we've largely merged those two things together. So that is, in some sense, the outline already shows some level of progress. To give a feel for the perspective of what we're doing, in just a few short years that the Large Hadron Collider has been running, we've published several hundred papers. There are four major experiments there, and each of them have published hundreds of papers. This FISAT series that Louis mentioned earlier has been the primary venue where particle physics and statisticians have come together to discuss what we do and how we could do it better. And they've evolved significantly over those years, and the LHC was in some sense a reboot, which allowed us to really change those procedures significantly. And I would like to, this is a personal message, thank Louis for having organized several of these things. It certainly had a large effect on my career, and so thank you, Louis. Okay, so let's get into it. So for fundamental particle physics, that's what we're talking about. You know that we start off with matter that you're familiar with, made out of atoms. Those atoms have a nucleus with electrons flying around them. The nucleus itself is made out of protons and neutrons. And then the level where you start to lose people usually is that the protons and neutrons themselves are not fundamental particles but are made out of things called quarks. Our current theory called the Standard Model thinks that things like the electron and things like the quarks are fundamental particles. So here's a little table of our 12 fundamental matter type of particles, and they interact through four fundamental forces. There's gravity, which sort of sits outside of the context of the Standard Model, and then there's the electromagnetic force, which is responsible for chemistry and cell phones and things like that. And then there are two forces that are inside of the nucleus of an atom, the strong nuclear force, which keeps, for instance, the protons together in the inside of a nucleus, and the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for things like radioactive decay. So all of this phenomena, which really describes at the fundamental level essentially everything that we, you know, see in the universe, is amazingly described by one equation. So this is called the Lagrangian of the Standard Model. It's written here in a very compact form. Several of these symbols are really, you know, packaged versions of something more complicated. But nevertheless, you can write it down in this simple expression, and I teach this to my graduate particle physics students. And this theory is really a, you know, triumph of mankind in terms of everything that it's able to do. So this is my high-level summary of particle physics. You don't need to understand it, but I thought since we have a mathematical crowd, I will just say it. Okay, so this equation here is called the Lagrangian. And so what is that all about? So the Standard Model is basically each of these particles that I showed you is some sort of field that permeates space and time. And the idea is that there are certain transformations that you can make to those fields, which leaves this object called the Lagrangian invariant. So it is a real valued number, which is related to essentially the energy of the configuration of all of these fields. And since you know, if you know how the, what the energy associated to a configuration of the field is, you can figure out how that thing will evolve in time. And so that's why this is sort of the central object. There are some, the transformations that we talk about are called gauge symmetries, and there's, you know, they're typically, Lie groups and things like that. So once you have this Lagrangian, you can make, predictions into the future about how a system will evolve. And usually what we do, is think about, wave-like solutions for free particles moving. So like two electrons moving in space have a wave-like solution. And they, if they scatter off of each other, you look into this Lagrangian to understand what kind of interactions would take place. And we usually draw them with something like this is called a Feynman diagram. You read it with time going to the right. So there are two particles coming in, some sort of complicated interaction. And here there's one, two, three, four, five, six particles going out. And so we're able to describe the energies and angles of all of these outgoing particles. So here there's six particles. Each of them has an energy and, say, two angles to describe its direction. So that's 18-dimensional distribution that we can describe in closed form. So we can describe an 18-dimensional joint distribution or how all of these particles fly out. And that makes particle physics interesting because most people can't do something like that. The way that it's done is essentially through something like a Taylor series. So these Feynman diagrams are essentially related to terms in a Taylor series. But an important part is that the theory, it's nice and calculable in this one regime, but then you get into a different regime where the theory is not really calculable, and then we have to resort to different kinds of phenomenological models. And we get sources of uncertainty that arise from these phenomenological models where the first principles theory isn't really applicable. Okay, so non-trivial aspects of this theory have been tested to better than one part in a million. Here are some fancy-looking Feynman diagrams that are related to a quantity that we measured. So you see this times 10 to the minus 10. It's actually, this is just the difference from 2. So there's actually, 10 digits here that we took for granted. And then we were able to measure the difference, to less than a part per million. So this is like really fantastic that we were able to predict something that accurately and measure it that accurately. And it's like hitting this is sort of precision equivalent to hitting a hole in one from New York to China. So in terms of energy scales, that's usually how we think about things in particle physics. We think about energies, so that GeV is our unit of energy. And I'll just put it in context. So things like chemical reactions are way down here at 10 to the minus 10 GeV, nuclear fission, the mass of a proton. If you think of E equals mc squared, you can take a proton and turn it purely into energy. That's 1 GeV. Then the Large Hadron Collider is out here at a 14 tera electron volts. The highest energy cosmic rays are even higher energy, but there are very few of them. And then there's some sort of fundamental energy scale called the Planck scale, where gravity would start to become important. And this is sort of the, the holy grail that we would someday be able to understand what's going on over here. But the LHC is running here, and there's one dot that I didn't label. And that is because our theory tells us that we should expect something interesting to happen at this energy scale, something we haven't seen before. And that's why we built the LHC to be even more energetic, so we can study that phenomenon. I won't go into the logic leading to that, but this is a picture of the Large Hadron Collider, the accelerator itself. So this, you can see it's a very long tunnel. So it goes around Geneva, Switzerland. These two little ribbons of particles are beams of protons that have about the energy of an aircraft carrier when it's cruising. You can melt 7 tons of copper with the energy in that beam. And so these protons are essentially going the speed of light. They go around and around, and they collide in the middle of our very large particle detectors. So this is about the size of this building that we're in right now. These are the two protons coming together. And when they hit each other, they ignite the production of new kinds of particles through E equals mc squared, and those particles fly out and are detected and measured by our big particle detector. That detector has about 100 million electronic readouts in it. These are all obviously not off-the-shelf thing that you buy. It took about 10 years to build this, and crammed with electronics. And so let me now try to review kind of the overarching picture of how we make predictions. So in the beginning, we have this fundamental Lagrangian that works in this language called quantum field theory. We make a systematic series of approximations to it with these Feynman diagrams, which are sort of akin to Taylor series. But then these particles that we can predict what's flying out, we now have to simulate how they interact in the detector. So here's a picture of the detector, and you see particles flying out and being measured by different components of the detector. And we simulate this with very detailed computer simulations. It takes about 20 minutes to simulate one of these interactions on a computer, and in real life, the interactions are happening 40 million times a second. So there's a very large hierarchy between how often the collisions are actually happen and how long it takes to simulate them. And then finally, we don't look at all 100 million electronic readouts. We run algorithms on this to try to identify certain kinds of features, for instance, the presence of an electron or a muon or different kinds of particles. So these algorithms run on these electronic signals in the detector and try to find which particles were there, what their energies were, which direction they went in, and things like that. Okay. So now this will be the sort of the only physics equation I have for you, which is that the expected number of interactions or scatterings of a particular type is given by something called the cross-section, which is associated to the type of interaction you're talking about, and then the luminosity, which is essentially the number, the flux of protons that you have, or the number of trials you had of throwing protons at each other to make this collision happen. And so you can think of it as sort of a probability for the collision to happen and the number of trials, except for the way that we do it, they carry units of area and inverse area. So this expected number of events is written sigma for the cross-section and L for luminosity. This shows, as a function of the energy of these collisions, this cross-section, or you can just think of it in terms of the number of events per second you would expect at the LHC. So the total interaction rate is very high. Okay, it's a gigahertz. And then most of the processes that happen are things that we've understood for a long time. Then you go down several orders of magnitude and you start seeing things that were discovered in the 80s, things that were discovered in the 90s, and now things that we're looking for that are happening about, 8-9 orders of magnitude less often. Okay. This is a plot that shows how much data we took as a function of time in 2011 in these sort of goofy units. And so if you take the total amount of data that we have and multiply it by this cross-section, you get 4 times 10 to the 14 collisions. So that's how many collisions we had last year. So we have a lot of data. And then we're going through looking for the 1 in a billion interactions that would be things like the Higgs boson or new kinds of particles like supersymmetry. So here are some pictures. These are called jets, these sprays of particles that group together. They're related to things like quarks and gluons. We've known about them for a while. These are the most common types of interactions. So that's way up here, the red line. Now going down into these black lines, this is something we were able to study at the beginning of last year. So here's a Z boson decaying into 2 muons that travel all the way through the detector. Then going down even farther to this purple line, this is most likely the production of a top quark and an anti-top quark that decay into 2 B jets, a muon going out of the detector, and over here this is an electron. So all of these things happened. They were all these are the predictions from the theory, and then we've measured them now in our data, and so far the standard model is doing an excellent job of predicting what we would expect to see. Now this takes us into sort of the middle of last year. Now this is a muon, an electron, and another electron. So this is a candidate for a Higgs boson decaying into 4 leptons, is what we say. And this is the kind of thing that gets people pretty excited. And so we have 3 events out of the 4 times 10 to the 14 that look like this and are interesting. You have to go find them and try to understand what's the probability for that to happen if the Higgs isn't there, is basically in a nutshell. Okay, so, and this is the plot that started to make a fair amount of excitement in the last year. So you see this is 16 of March of this year. You see a distribution with a very small bump on top of it. When you take this together with things like what I just showed you, like this one, and you put them together, we're starting to see evidence at the roughly the three sigma level and two independent experiments for a Higgs boson being produced at roughly 100 with a mass of 125 GeV. So the hope is that if this is real, that by the end of this year, we may be over the coveted five sigma threshold and we'd be claiming the discovery of this particle that was predicted in 1964. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit about how we do this and how we model the data. Okay, now a few times I'm going to show some plots just because to give a visual, you know, feel for the complexity of what we're doing. So I'm going to start with something very simple. So I'm going to think of a Gaussian distribution. Okay, so I'm thinking of Gaussian of some variable x with a mean of mu and a standard deviation of sigma. And I'm going to draw them like this. So I'm going to think of the density itself as a node that depends on, so every node that you see will be a real valued function of the things that sit below it. So the density itself is a real valued number. So like if this is the value of x at minus 2, you know, the density is whatever it is. X is the value of the random variate, then the mean and the standard deviation are the parameters of the model. Okay, so that's how I'm going to draw them, and you'll see some other examples. Okay, so I'm going to use the term channel. Okay, now I'm just going to start to define some things so we're on the same page. So a channel is a subset of the data. We have these 4 times 10 to the 14 collisions. We go through all of those, and we make selections on them to find subsets of events that have certain characteristics. So, for instance, all the events that have 4 electrons with an energy of bigger than 10 GeV is a subset of the data, and that's what I'm calling a channel. Okay. There are n number of events that are observed in that channel and new number of events expected in that channel. Now, for each of those events, I might I measure lots of different things, but usually I pick one particular variable called a discriminating variable, which is going to help me discriminate between the signals in the background. Okay, so I'm going to call that discriminating variable X. And my data set is just a tuple of X1 through XN, the values of this discriminating variable or mark, okay? So the statisticians call this a marked Poisson process, so that the probability that I would get this data given new expected events is the Poisson probability that I get N events expecting new, and then the product over all of the events of some density for this discriminating variable. So at this point, there are no free parameters in the model, but that's I'm just starting. Okay. So the density and the total rate, I'll call the total rate also. The total rate is just given by, let me start over. This whole process is a mixture model, which comes from several different kinds of scatterings or, you know, physical interactions that could take place. So this is the typical kind of plot that we make. This is my discriminating variable. This is called the missing transverse energy. These are the total number of events that I see, and the different histograms are being stacked on top of each other, and they correspond to different physical processes that I expect to be, you know, to take place and to be contributing to this event selection. So the blue is coming from whatever diboson events. So, you know, there are different kinds of physical processes. I stack them all up. The total shape that I expect is a mixture of the distribution of each of these individual distributions weighted by the total the expected number of events from that kind of scattering process. So this is just a simple mixture model, and the total number of events is just the sum of all the different the rates from all the different interactions. So here's my F. That's this thing right here. It depends on some parameters, the new I, and then the densities, the Fi. Okay. So I'm going to start to expand this picture a little bit more. Okay. Now, at this point, I haven't parameterized it, so let me parameterize it for you. The distributions will start to depend on my parameter of interest, which I'll call mu, which has to do with either, for instance, the mass of some new particle, like the Higgs boson, which will change the shape of that distribution, or the total rate of events that I'm producing. And then there are nuisance parameters that are associated to uncertainties in the response of the detector or this phenomenological model of the theory in places where first principles theory is not available. Okay, so I'm calling the nuisance parameters theta, and I'm calling all of the parameters together alpha, and occasionally I'll pick out a particular parameter and I'll call it alpha sub p. Okay, so this leads to a parameterized model, so my total rate turns into nu of alpha, and my total PDF turns into f of x given alpha. And so now here's my marked Poisson model parameterized by alpha. Okay. Now when I do that, when I try to get these individual densities, there are sort of two typical ways that we use to model those densities. Which are basically parametric or non-parametric approaches. In both cases, we validate these models by using a very detailed simulation, computer simulation of the detector and the theory. In the parametric modeling, that's an example like this one that I showed you earlier. The distribution is so smooth and simple, people will just use something like a falling exponential or maybe a polynomial or something like that to describe this distribution. Here, in this case, the parameters of that polynomial, for instance, don't have a very clear physical interpretation, but they do a good job of modeling this distribution. In the non-parametric approach, the densities are estimated by using histograms or sometimes kernel estimation, where we have many, many examples of what these collisions look like using our computer simulation. So we have, so if I is the is an index for which example of this variable I have, so I have many computer simulated examples, and then J is an index for the fact that my simulation has many, many parameters, right? So a very complicated simulation of the detector has many knobs that you can turn, and so those are the alpha, and I have many different settings for them indexed by J. So I have all of these samples. I can make histograms for different versions, different settings for what my simulation is doing. Here it's nice because the parameters have a very clear interpretation. I can think of it as, for instance, the energy response of this part of the detector to electrons. That will be one of the alphas that I can turn. The problem is that how do I make a continuously parameterized function over all of these alphas when what I have are a discrete set of simulated events? And so typically what we do there, so let me show you, is that so here's a histogram, for instance, that comes from running the simulation with the nominal settings, what you think is the proper description of the simulation to describe, how the detector is actually behaving. But you can turn different knobs, and those histograms will all change a little bit. So this is a little table, the conceptual table. It says for each one of these knobs that I can turn, systematic one or systematic uncertainty two, dot, 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 or there might be several of them, I go to each of these histograms and I see how they change. So in the cells of the histogram, you can imagine a new histogram, the cells of the table, you can imagine a new histogram or a new rate corresponding to twiddling the knobs of my simulation. And so then from this table, I need to come up with some continuous, so here's, for instance, a histogram. You see three histograms corresponding to different settings of the simulation parameters, and then I want to interpolate in some way. So this, I'll just tell you now and try to wave my hands to draw your attention, is that this is the biggest weak point of what we do right now, by far. Okay, we're trying to interpolate a very complicated function. We are getting into the business of sort of 20 to 100 nuisance parameters that we're trying to track associated to how the detector responds, and how we interpolate in 20 dimensions is very ad hoc at this point, and it's like the place where we could use some help. Okay. So nevertheless, that's what we do. So now if I go back to this picture, so here's my mixture model. So there's the top level density that's coming from the component, the coefficients for each of the different densities. Now I take one of those densities and I explode it into something that's parameterizing over many, many histograms with different parameter settings. So now these little blue knobs correspond to all of the settings of my simulation that I can twiddle, so these different nuisance parameters, alpha p, and these are all describing the same variable x, which I'm measuring, the same discriminating variable x. So that was just expanding one of these nodes. If I expand all of the nodes, this graphical representation starts to look like this for just one channel. Okay. But we don't just have one channel. We look at several different regions of the data that are sensitive to different ways that a particle might decay. And so I would call it a simultaneous multi-channel model, where you just take essentially what I showed you before, the marked Poisson process for one of these selections, and I just multiply for all of the different channels that are involved, and my data becomes just the direct sum, I guess, of all of these different region, all of these different data sets for the individual channels. Okay, so this is close to the final thing. This is almost what we use. We do include different regions of the data where we don't actually expect any signal to be present, just because they're good at helping us measure these different parameters of the model. For instance, we might introduce a control sample of the data that just helps us essentially calibrate how the detector responds to the electrons or muons or something like that. Or there might be a particular process which the theory is very bad at predicting, but we have a lot of data with that process in it, so we can just measure the rate of that process with some control sample. So this idea of including control regions is an additional channel in the model, even though there's no signal, is something that we did a little bit before, but has become much more mainstream recently. And the nice thing here is that by incorporating these control regions directly into the model, we're converting things that we used to consider systematics with a very fuzzy and ambiguous definition of how you understand them statistically. So we just dubbed them bad systematics into good systematics, where we actually have a statistical description for what's going on. So it really, in some sense, is a type of statistical uncertainty and not a systematic one. So the prototype example that we've discussed a lot in the Feistat series is that the simplest one, where you strip away everything, so you don't have any discriminating variables. You only have the Poisson count, and you have two regions, a signal region and a control region. And so mu is the parameter of interest that I care about, and nu b is some nuisance parameter associated to a background rate in my signal region. If I don't know the true background rate, but I can introduce a control region that also depends on nu b, and this tau is thought of as a constant factor that's known, then this control region, the measurement m, is giving me information about the background rate, which can propagate into the signal region, but it's all done in one step instead of two separate steps. So that has been, so in terms of progress, I think that is a big step forward, as we've just gotten into the habit of trying to include as many of these control samples as possible. Okay, now in some cases, there are control measurements that there's an entire group of people that just try to understand how a part of the detector behaves and how it's calibrated and things like that, and they make special measurements to try to do these calibrations. And in principle, those measurements could be incorporated just like I described, but typically that's not done just because it's too much work, or because people are working in a different framework or some practical reason. So in those cases, what we usually have from those measurements is just a maximum likelihood estimate for the nuisance parameter alpha p, which I'll denote AAP, and a standard error. So given that information, I just have an MLE and then a standard error for the energy response of a certain part of the detector. I need to include that information when I do into my statistical model. So I'm calling those constraint terms. They're simplified or idealized versions of how the MLE could depend on those nuisance parameters. Typically, that would just be a Gaussian. But when you have large uncertainties and some of these parameters have physical boundaries, like the rate of events can't be negative, it has to be a positive number, so then the Gaussian is not such a good choice anymore, because it's predicting sort of a negative number of events. So we started using either Poisson or log normal distributions for these sort of simplified, idealized constraint terms. So once I'll also just draw attention to the fact that we're taking, pain to write it in a frequentist way. So we think of what is the distribution of this measured quantity, the MLE, given the true value of the nuisance parameters, instead of thinking of it as in sort of a Bayesian sense and saying, given that I made that measurement, that calibration measurement, this is my posterior probability for my nuisance parameter. And the reason that we're making that pain is because a lot of what our statistical tests, we want to be done in a frequentist way. And previously, we always had a bit of a hybrid procedure where these kinds of systematic effects were dealt with in a Bayesian way, but our main result was trying to be frequentist. And so now we've made the sort of switch of being able to extract these nuisance parameters and distributions and describe them in a frequentist way to have a sort of more consistent statistical formalism. So then the total model that we end up with is this product over all the different channels of the marked Poisson for each channel, and then a product of several of these constraint terms that are helping you know, constrain the various nuisance parameters. So the data here is what I showed before, and the script G is sort of another thing that's new, is that the script G is a set of these MLEs that have been measured by all of these different specialized measurements for calibrations and things like that. And what's the reason I'm drawing attention to it is when we do frequentist techniques and we want to build sampling distributions, we always considered that the calibration measurements were sort of done a priori and fixed, and they have a fixed value. And our ensemble only was randomizing the data in our main measurements, this data sum here. But what we realized was that if we want to do it in a strict frequentist way, we need to imagine that the whole experiment, the whole LHC project was being repeated over and over again, and that the calibration constants, the measurements of the calibration constants themselves are coming out differently. So the script G is for these MLEs of all these different auxiliary measurements are also being randomized, which is maybe to the statisticians not such a strange thing, but for physicists this was a very, you know, counterintuitive switch to make and caused a lot of confusion for some time. Okay. So now to give you a feel of the complexity of what we're dealing with, for instance, in the Higgs search, this is just a table of different ways the Higgs can decay, different way some of these particles are also unstable and they have their subsequent decays. And then when you go to look for this particle in the data, there are different experimental issues that you need to deal with, and you can add some sensitivity to your search by subdividing the data in various different ways and slicing and dicing it so that you understand each piece individually. And this table, which I don't expect you to go through, it just gives you some feel of all of the different sub regions of the data, these different channels. In total, we have about 70 different channels in the data that we're simultaneously modeling. We're tracking more than 100 now, more like 500 different nuisance parameters, and this is what it looked like in the fall of last year, and now it's about 10 times bigger, and I'm sort of running out of ability to make the plot anymore. So this is a big spaghetti plot, is sort of a graphical representation of what the combined Higgs search looks like. And part of the reason I'm showing you this picture is that this is an exact, each node here also corresponds to a C++ class. There's an instance of some C++ class. So this is an exact representation of how it's done in software. And what's nice is that this very top node here is, you know, the density F. And, you know, somewhere in here is like the Higgs mass. And, you know, somewhere over here is the Higgs cross section. And I can take this big thing in software and save it into a file and send it to you in an email. Okay. And, or I can publish it along with our papers. And this is not something that we're really doing yet, but in terms of, you know, where the field could go, we have the ability to publish our likelihood functions in a level of detail that's very, you know, impressive. And it's more than just a likelihood function because it's the full model. We can use this to generate pseudo data and actually calculate sampling distributions. We can refit it. You can do, you know, basically everything you want with this structure. So, and this is how we actually perform the combinations. We have different subgroups each send us a file like this, and then we have some software that puts it together into the big combined statistical model. So I think that this is something I've been involved with, and it's something that sort of spearheaded in the FISTAT meeting of 2005. So this is basically the last 6.5 years worth of work is to get to the point that we can do this. Okay. So now in terms of statistical tests, how am I?
11 minutes.
Okay. So now let me move away from modeling and talk about statistical tests and the progress that we've made. So now we're going to take for granted that we have this model. We've taken a lot of care to write it in a sort of the frequentist sense, because once we get the data, it implies the likelihood function, and we can do anything in terms of likelihood-based inference, or we can multiply it by a prior and new Bayesian inference, or we still leave open the possibility to do just pure frequentist p-values and confidence intervals. So particle physicists, I think Jim Berger called us frequentist dinosaurs because we still really do stick to the frequentist procedures for the most part, and we do worry about things like coverage and et cetera. Of course, we do also use Bayesian techniques, but I'd say that for a lot of particle physicists, there's a general dislike for assigning prior probabilities to theoretical parameters like the mass of a particle we haven't observed or whether or not it even exists at all. So that's why that is the core reason that people have been slow to just take on Bayesian procedures whole hog. And then this point that I just made is that once we make the model in this frequentist sense, of course we can do likelihood-based inference or Bayesian inference, and we do. Okay. So I will talk about what we've done on the frequentist side for a little bit. In the 1990s, the previous experiment called around the LEP collider at CERN were doing these types of, you know, Higgs searches, for instance. And that's when the use of a likelihood ratio first became very popular in particle physics, and thinking of it for hypothesis tests. In that case, the systematic uncertainties in that collider were very small. So you really could think of it as sort of a point hypothesis test. There was a situation where the Higgs boson doesn't exist and a situation where it does exist. It was very clean, simple hypothesis testing. And this is why, the Nyman-Pearson lemma and everything, this is why this became popular. In the 2000s, roughly, the Tevatron took the lead in terms of searches for new physics like this. But because of the nature of that collider, there are larger uncertainties that you have to deal with. So you can't stick with the simple likelihood ratio. You need to go to something different. So that's when, some sense of profiling started to happen. So that here I'm thinking of mu equals 1 as the presence of signal and mu equals 0 as the background only or null hypothesis. So the nuisance parameters are here being profiled at their respective values. And this was somehow just a natural generalization of the line above. But at the LHC, what we've started to move to is really just to use the profile likelihood ratio directly, so that instead of testing somehow mu equals 0 against mu equals 1, we're testing a specific value of mu against whatever the best fit is. And one of the reasons that we have moved towards in this direction is because with Wilk's theorem, we now understand these things better, is that asymptotically this test statistic has a distribution that is independent of the true values of the nuisance parameters, while this one does not. Okay, so that has been, somewhat of a change in terms of how we do things. Here I'll call T whatever test statistic you choose to use. There's also a change in how we calculate p-values. Previously, these thetas, remember, are the different nuisance parameters, and we didn't have a good way to calculate frequentist p-values dealing with all of these systematic effects. So what we typically did was our p-value, this is an integral from the observed value of the test statistic to infinity, so the tail probability of this quantity, and this quantity you can think of as an averaged model or an average distribution for the test statistic averaging over some prior distribution for the nuisance parameters. So here you see this kind of hodgepodge of Bayesian and frequentist thinking, and it's basically because it was very intuitive and we didn't have a better way to do it at the time. So, of course, frequentist p-value should be calculated for specific points in mu theta and not averaging over theta in this Bayesian way. And the confidence interval for the parameter of interest would be defined by all of the points mu such that, you know, the value of the test statistic is greater or less than some threshold, given that mu and theta have some specific values. But you would want this probability to be less than the size of your test for all the values of theta. And that's the difficult part, is that how do you do a Nyman construction in 500 dimensions, right? So checking this is computationally challenging, but what we moved to through some combination of Gary Feldman gave a talk at one of the FISTAT conferences, Louis gave me a good piece of advice to follow up this problem for FISTAT 2003, which was also held at SLAC, and then it was followed up by some work by Matthew Walker, Bodhi Sen, and Michael Woodruff, and then they sort of discovered or, you know, pointed us to the literature by Shuang and Lai and the statistics community. And this is pretty much contemporary with when Feldman gave his talk, so they basically happened all at the same time. But anyways, the idea here is that instead of trying to check all values of the nuisance parameters, you only check one value of the nuisance parameter, which is a good guess for being the thing that maximizes this probability, and that value is the profile value of the nuisance parameter given the value of mu that you want to test in the observed data. So what these papers show basically is a collection of different examples where this has been tested to see how well this procedure which is called the hybrid resampling method in statistics and sort of the profile construction and physics, how well it behaves. But so far, it seems to behave quite well, and that's how we're dealing with this problem. Okay, I'm there. In terms of the test statistic, we did know about Wilkes' theorem and that the distribution of the log likelihood ratio looks like a chi-square for when the value that was tested is the same as the true value. But we were basically, I would say, ignorant of Wald's theorem that says that when you want to ask what, for instance, the test for the background only looks like when you assume the alternate hypothesis, we didn't really know about that, and we learned about that and realized that it's related to this non-central chi-square. And the non-centrality parameter is related to the Fisher information of your model, but that can be difficult to calculate. So we sort of learned this, and Glenn and myself and Ofer Vittels and Alan Gross wrote some paper where we took the typical tests of particle physics and just essentially applied Wilkes and Wald's theorem to get some handy equations. And we also came up with what's perhaps a clever trick, which is called the Asimov data, so I'll just tell you briefly. So this Fisher information would be an expectation of the second derivative of the log likelihood ratio, and that means you need to generate lots of pseudo experiments or pseudo data sets to calculate this expectation and then understand what this second derivative matrix looks like. And that can be computationally challenging. So what we realized was that at least in the case where you have a distribution that's binned, and you think of each of those as being Poisson, each bin being Poisson distributed, there's a very simple way to calculate this, which is to make up a fake data set where the values, the entries of the data set are exactly what you expect in the model. And because the second derivative is linear in the number of events that you expect, this is just a simple way of sort of computing this expectation. But practically speaking, it's very nice because all the machinery that you have for fitting an observed data set also applies to this fake data set. You stick in a fake data set with some special properties, and out comes the expected Fisher information. And so that's been useful, for instance, calculating the non-centrality parameter, which we need for Wald's theorem. It's useful for calculating Jeffrey's prior, and also will be useful for reference analysis. And I should point out here that Luke and Harrison and some other people have made some progress in reference analysis in particle physics. So here's just an example of how it's doing. These blue and red sort of histograms come from running many, many pseudo experiments and fitting each one and calculating this profile likelihood ratio test statistic. And the lines that go right through those curves come from the asymptotic results. So we basically learned standard asymptotic theory, but we also have this kind of clever trick with the Asimov data so that we can do this quickly. And just to give you a feel of how significant this is, when you do this on the combined Higgs model to try to, you know, make our typical plots, we spend 100,000 CPU hours to generate all those pseudo experiments and do all the fits. So so this is a very, you know, for practical reasons, a huge step forward. Of course, we are also investigating other approaches when the asymptotic distributions haven't fully set in. So, for instance, Michael Woodruff made some suggestions about importance sampling at Banff. We've been following up on that, and okay, I don't have time to go into the details, but we have essentially a different way of doing this importance sampling that's scaling better for our very complicated models, which if you're interested in, I can talk about. And this is just shows you how we can get out to these very small p-values with many, many fewer pseudo experiments using importance sampling. I won't talk about power constraint limits, CLS, negatively biased relevant subsets, and various things, which was a bit of a brouhaha in the particle physics community. It's a can of worms, but I just thought I would say that the whole discussion about upper limits when you have a bounded nuisance parameter and things related to this Mandelkern paper have kind of reflared again, but have subsided since. And then I'll just show, sorry, I'm concluding here, is that this is from the combined search for the Higgs. This is just one of the examples where you see with the same big model and the same implementation of the model that I was showing you, we're doing inference on that model with three different techniques. So there's, you know, the solid line here is coming from the asymptotic likelihood procedures and the Asimov data set. The blue dots are coming from ensemble tests where we actually generate many, many pseudo data sets and repeat the whole procedure and do, this is a one-sided upper limit doing a Nyman construction. And then the purple dots are coming from a Bayesian procedure. So we actually have the machinery to do all of these. This is just flashing that we can calculate things like the Jeffries prior with this Asimov data set. And then let me just conclude with the look elsewhere effect. So this is a plot that shows, I showed this earlier, the two big experiments, Atlas and CMS, as a function of the Higgs mass hypothesis, what the p-value for the background only is. And you see that we're both dipping into the 3 sigma neighborhood, very small p-values at roughly the same spot. But of course you see there's also lots of other features here. And that's because the location of the signal that we're looking for, we don't know what the true mass of the Higgs boson is, so we have to look for it and we have to scan it. So it is a classical example of when you have, so here's an example of a bump sitting on top of some background, a classical example where you have a parameter that's defined only under the null. And so this gives, if you don't know the location of this, it changes the distributions of all of your test statistics. And we have recently sort of discovered the results by Davies, Rice, Ledbetter, and company about how to understand distributions of a likelihood ratio test statistic when you have parameters that aren't defined under your null. So there's a nice paper by Alam and Ofer, which is now being used quite a bit in particle physics, and I think Jan will mention that for astrophysics as well. I don't really have time here, but these are just different sampling distributions, and I was going to make a subtle point about the fact that we are now using these results by Ledbetter, sort of thinking about the same thinking that we're using for a chi-square random field, but instead of crossing a specific threshold, crossing a threshold that changes, and that is allowing us to be able to include certain deviations in the test statistic distribution from the asymptotic results, which have to do with basically a slow convergence to the asymptotic results. So this is sort of really the leading edge of what we're doing at this point. Okay, so I had a conclusion. Should I read the conclusions? The challenges, I think the biggest challenge we have now on the modeling side is this multidimensional interpolation. We've improved various things in terms of how we're doing that, but I think this, as we've been able to do better job of turning systematics into essentially statistical uncertainties, there's more attention that's turning towards truly systematic uncertainties. And I think there, Brad Efron's talk about model selection is relevant because essentially we usually just take our model as given, but there's a lot of arbitrariness in how we do that. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
I think we'll try to allow time for maybe one or two quick questions. Are there questions up there? All the way back there. Maybe I'll.
I was just wondering if complications arise when if you have channels that share events, so they're not independent of each other.
The complications would certainly arise. We just don't let that happen, basically. We're not allowing ourselves to have selections with our selections are totally disjoint. There have been procedures like this blue method that at the level of combining sort of likelihoods when there's some overlap, but in this type of procedure we have insisted that they be disjoint.
I think in the interest of time, I better move us along to our next speaker. Well, I hope you will join me in thanking Kyle for an informative talk. Our next speaker is Stefano Marchesini.
I use my computer, but yes.
So my name is Stefano Marchesini from Advanced Light Source. I'm going to talk about the inverse problems in X-ray science, in photon science. The photon science is very diverse and very somewhat different from cosmology and particle physics. For one thing, we have very different types of problems, materials that we study. So first of all, I'm going to give an overview of photon science. It's a very big deal, so I'll try to do my best in this short time. And then I will talk about a few inverse problems. In particular, I will give us some examples of a linear inverse problem in tomography, a non-linear inverse problem, which are diffraction methods, and then finally I will say something about the fact that there's going to be a lot of data and we can take advantage of that to improve resolution, signal to noise, and quality of the data. This is an picture of the this is the place where I work, the brightness versus energy. This is the place where I work at Advanced Light Source. Here is LCLS. So LCLS is much brighter, but synchrotron radiation also produces a lot of enough signal, and it has something of the order of 50 simultaneous experiments going on at the same time, all that can produce similar quantities of data as a Friedlander laser. So what do people want to look at, use photons? Mainly it's to study materials or samples or things that exist in nature. And people like microscopic things. And what people want to see from materials, proteins, molecules, is first of all the structure. To understand its function, you probably want to know the structure, where the atoms are in a protein, for example, how it, in order to understand how it's going to bind to other molecules and react to the environment. You want to know the electronic properties, the chemical structure, and okay.
Way back at the back.
So electronic properties, we want to know the chemical structure of materials such as batteries or superconductors or things like that. And finally, you want to know the dynamic evolution of this. So that's the purpose of using X-rays is that the reason why we use X-rays. But the physics problem is all understood. The interaction of X-rays with matter is somewhat classical physics. We have X-rays that go through material, and X-rays that come out, they come out just straight, and this is you can measure absorption or refraction effects. They can scatter out of the forward direction, and inside the material they can excite fluorescent photons, electrons, or inelastic X-ray scattering. The reason why we like X-rays are useful is because the wavelength is comparable to the atom size. The penetration is of the order, can be depending on the wavelength, it can be from microns to meters. You can go to the doctor and get a tomogram yourself. So X-rays penetrate through big things. The energy is useful to probe valence bands and electronic states inside the material, and you can create short time scales and also study for a long time. So the first thing I want to the application of X-ray science, there are many people that come to do experiments in a synchrotron or in a light source, and these include solid-state physicists that do spectroscopy, biologists that want to know the structure of proteins or image biological cells at high resolution. You have chemistry and material science, where people study photovoltaics, batteries, catalysts, etc., in order to understand how to make them better. Earth science, where people study diffusion processes. Space science, where people, when samples come back from space, like stardust, they're typically characterized using X-rays. And then even archaeology and semiconductors and so on. Just to give you an idea of what a typical synchrotron, the activity of a typical synchrotron, there are three main thrust of techniques. There's diffraction, that represent almost about 50% of the experimental activities in a synchrotron. You have spectrum microscopy or microscopy, which is about a quarter at the advanced light source. And then you have spectroscopy, various forms of spectroscopy methods. On any day, there are about 50 people. Any time of the day, any time of the night, there are about 50 people doing experiments that include different fields, from structural biology, energy science, and so on. So, let me give you one example of what this type of interaction, where you have X-rays that come in and electrons that come out. So if you look at Allen-Gorozov photoemission, you get a picture that shows the density of states, roughly, of bonding energy versus momentum space. This is a complicated, fairly complicated experiment. It takes bright source and advanced detectors to do. But once you get an image like that, from a data analysis point of view, this is pretty much what you get. You can't do much more than that. And then what you want to do is compare with the model. But in terms of statistical data analysis, doesn't have very much. There's a lot of complication in calculating the model here, but the data is fairly straightforward. So what I want to focus on is this other part, where X-rays come in and they get they interact with the material by either absorption or scattering and diffraction. So the contrast mechanism is fairly simple. You have an incident beam that goes to the material. This is a transmission function that is given by the absorption coefficient. The more absorbing the material is, the more contrast you get, and the thicker it is, the more contrast also you get. If you go through a thick object in a ray optics, the X-rays go in, they interact with the first part of the material, and then keep going and so on. And you can use different approximations on how the transmission of X-rays through the material behave. The little approximation, or bond approximation, or further approximation. So if you use just a simple, plain, classical physics ray optics, you have a material that you want to study, and what you do is you measure the absorption coefficient as the X-rays propagate through the material. And so what you do is each measurement represents a projection of your sample, and what you'd want to do is from this all these projections, you want to reconstruct a three-dimensional object. You can do this this is a projection. You can use the projection slice, Fourier slice theorem to put every projection into a Fourier plane. And then with an inverse Fourier transform, you can reconstruct the object, or roughly reconstruct the object. Because the problem typically is that people have little patience. And in order to collect a full high-quality image of your object, you need to collect very many angles. And this is a limiting factor. You want to study the material. If you want to study the material that evolves in time, for example, you cannot wait until you cover the entire Fourier space. And so there are, however, some interesting optimization methods that allows you to reconstruct the object if you know something about it. For example, the fact that the object is sparse. By using regularization techniques that I've heard the first talk talking about Lasso. So basically here they use total variation regularization in order to reconstruct an object that is piecewise smooth. Now there is going to be a talk by Rebecca Willett tomorrow. They will probably talk more about this kind of underdetermined linear inverse problems. And now I want to go into the nonlinear part of my talk. First of all, X-ray microscopy. In X-ray microscopy, basically, you have the same similar situation as in tomography, where you have some X-rays that go through the sample, but now you have an optical element that will magnify your object. So if you could do this with at very high resolution with X-rays, then you could do tomography at extremely high resolution. The problem is that making a lens for X-rays, since X-rays penetrate through matter and don't interact very strongly, making a lens, especially for hard X-rays, is very difficult. And it's impossible to make a lens that gives you atomic resolution because you need to fabricate an optical element with an atomic resolution. So what you do is you get away with the lens. You just record the diffraction pattern. The geometry is very simple. You have a sample. You hit it with X-rays. You collect the diffraction pattern. It gets complicated afterwards. The problem here is that the data analysis is nonlinear because diffraction. What you do in this kind of in the diffraction measurement is that you only measure the intensity of the diffracted light and you don't measure the phase. So you need to recover the phase. So now I'm going to talk about scattering and diffraction techniques. Okay, a little bit of timeline. So in 1905, Roentgen discovered X-rays. In 1912, Bragg was able to solve the structure of salt, sodium chloride. Basically, he only recorded a few diffraction peaks, and from that, he could tell the distance between atoms and assemble a crystal accordingly. In 1950s, first proteins started to be solved. People knew almost a lot about, for example, the alpha helix in a protein. They knew the composition, the sequence of the atoms, but they didn't know how they would fold together. And however, by just using a single spot in a diffraction pattern that gives you the pitch of a helix, Pauling was able to infer the structure of the alpha helix. And a few years later, Watson and Crick did the almost the same thing, using a few more spots to infer the structure of DNA. And now, 2012, almost 70,000 proteins solved, and many other things going on. So the one thing that I should say, when X-rays go in, they penetrate to material and then they scatter out. You have elastic scattering, and what elastic scattering gives you is essentially a two-dimensional Fourier transform of the object. And if the object is three-dimensional, in reality, because of the fact that the photon coming in and the photon going out have the same mass, since it's elastic scattering, they must have the same momentum. And so the momentum space that you record is on a sphere, which casts so each detector measurement represents a slice, a two-dimensional slice in Fourier space of the Fourier transform of the object. You still have the problem of solving the phase problem. So, the phase problem is fairly simple. Typically, if, for example, let's see here we have an object made of, for example, two slits. You have X-rays that go in. When you do a Fourier transform, you go, this is a typical Young's fringe interference pattern. You get a fringe pattern with a certain frequency. Now, this is what you measure, and you want to recover the position of these two peaks. This is a very simple case, because we know there are two peaks, but if you just take the Fourier transform magnitude and do an inverse Fourier transform, you recover the autocorrelation, which has three peaks. So you have to basically be able to recover from the autocorrelation the original object, or from the Fourier magnitude squared, the original object. And this is a nonlinear optimization problem. Moreover, we know that the solution in general is not unique. So our problem is we have an object that we want to find. We measure its Fourier transform magnitude squared, and we want to recover this from this measurement. If we know nothing about the measurement, but we know that we can make changes to the object that will give the same exact diffraction pattern. We can translate it, flip it, we can translate it, flip it, we can add a phase factor, and the diffraction pattern will still look the same. We consider these as trivial solutions. If we recover an object that is rotated, it's not the end of the world. It's still useful information. But there is another case that is homomorphic structures. You can build any number of them. You just take two objects that are non-centrosymmetric, like for example, this triangle and this triangle. You convolve them in different ways. In one case, you just convolve them. The other case, you flip one of them. And when you do the Fourier transform and take the magnitude square, they will look exactly the same. However, in the early 80s, a number of people showed that these structures are extremely rare, and especially if you go to two and three dimensions. However, so we can say that in some cases the solution is actually unique, unless you get into this very difficult situation, but we still don't have a very good way of finding this solution. There are methods, experimental methods, to actually solve the phase problem. One method is by Gabor in the 1940s. So in the Gabor holographic method, this is a slight variation from its Gabor, from the original Gabor paper. So you have an object that you want to know, and you have you introduce a delta function nearby that allows you to solve the phase problem, because once you measure the Fourier transform magnitude square, you do an inverse Fourier transform, you get the autocorrelation of this object, and the autocorrelation contains three number of terms, one of which is the convolution between the unknown object and the delta function that we introduced. This is great, but you still have to be able to make a delta function and put it next to the object. And this delta function, if you want atomic resolution, has to be atomic resolution delta function, which is experimentally is not feasible. Now, there is also problems of how much sampling you do from diffraction data. Let's say that here our object, again, is just made of two peaks. When you do a Fourier transform, you get a structure with a certain number, a certain bandwidth, and the sampling can be too low, especially if in the case of a periodic repetition of the same sample. So if you have a periodic repetition of the same sample, you get in trouble with the sampling. So, right, let me get into the optimization problem that we're trying to solve. So we measure something that is proportional to the Fourier transform magnitude square. The complication comes from the fact that typically we have missing information and there is some form of averaging during the experiment that can be due to the fact that the incident light on the X-ray beam can be have a number of multiple wavelengths. It can be moving and rotating around during the exposure, or you can have a small crystal that will spread out the diffraction path. And then there are also other problems of the fact that there is typically missing information. So we have data that is a problem that is nonlinear, and we have some complications to do that I will show you in a bit. So what we want to do is find this object whose Fourier transform satisfies the measurement, subject to some constraints that we know about the object. Some of the key is how to find, how to solve this problem, and what kind of prior knowledge you apply to your inverse problem. The typical iterative methods, you have a real space constraint. For example, you know the object is maybe positive or sparse, and you have a measurement, and you go back and forth between real space, the data space, and the real space where you have the constraint, and apply different forms of projection methods. Now, let me go through different branches of diffraction. So I just described to you the fact that sometimes you get different types of measurements, Fourier components, depending on what kind of averaging you do. So, for example, in diffraction, you have different branches. One is, let's say that you have a small molecule, like salt, and you collect diffraction patterns. Then in this case, people use direct methods. Direct methods are an old technique from the 1950s that somehow enables to find a sparse solution to the diffraction pattern. These small powder crystals, they also use the same type of technique, but also kind of trial and error Monte Carlo type of reconstruction techniques. In proton crystallography, they use a combination of all possible techniques until they find a solution. But typically, in order to solve the protein structure ab initio without knowing anything about it, is to introduce a strong contrast atom and do either anomalous diffraction. And this is somewhat similar to the case of holography that I just described, where if you have a few strong peaks around your object, it facilitates solving the phase problem. And there's solution scattering, where they use Monte Carlo techniques. And there is more, a single particle diffraction where you have a compact support around the object that you either know or you shrink around. You have nanocrystallography, Anton Barty will talk about this, where you not only have a phase material problem, but you also have an orientation determination problem because you collect many diffraction patterns but you don't know the orientation and you have to average them. Same problem is with a single particle diffraction. And in macrocrystallography, people just scan through the sample and look and try to find what kind of crystal is inside the material. And in scanning diffraction, I will describe this later. Just to kind of repeat these branches of diffraction, let me show you this the difference between the graphic difference between these. So in single particle, you just have a plain single particle and collect diffraction patterns from it. You assume coherent illumination on the sample, so that the Fourier transform property applies. So you basically recall something that is the Fourier transform square of the density of the original object. Plus, typically, you have some missing information because the detector is damaged, or the beam is too intense in part of the detector and you cannot record it. This is normally a cause of big trouble. Then the single molecule diffractive imaging is almost the same problem, except that now you also introduce an unknown orientation to the data, and you have, and Anton Bartsch and probably other people will talk about it. And partly in crystallography, you also have the fact that bright sampling introduces a small subsampling in the data. So essentially, you get a lot of bright peaks. This allows you to enhance the signal to noise. However, it reduces the number of data points that you collect because you only collect diffraction data on the bright peak. Now, in protein nanocrystallography, you add the fact that you have undersample, subsample diffraction data, plus unknown orientation. So it gets more complicated. You start a diffraction where you have an ensemble of crystals, and you collect the diffraction pattern of the average of all these small crystals. What you get is a ring structure around the sample. Now, you would think, why would anyone do this? Well, because in many cases it's just not possible to grow big crystals, and part of diffraction is a simple way to collect data. And if the crystal is simple enough, or the structure is simple enough, you can actually recover the entire structure just from this radial average. So this kind of technique is still very popular and used widely. Now, solution scattering is the most difficult problem of all. You have a completely random orientation of a single molecule, and you collect the diffraction pattern of the average of this. The amount of data in the diffraction pattern is very limited because basically it's a radial average of something that is fairly smooth. So you average all the possible orientation, and plus you have missing information in the middle. But however, this is also a very popular technique, million-dollar operation in all the synchrotrons with dedicated beam lines. Ah, there's low diffraction, another one where you go in with a different wavelengths, so now you have to average over different wavelengths. Now, the coherent diffractive imaging basically is the single particle diffractive imaging where you have a macroscopic sample. Before, most of the diffraction techniques used to be done on proteins. Now we're looking at bigger things like micron-sized things like biological cells, or this is a test object. And it started roughly in 1999, first demonstration by Zhang Yao and others. And what they did first, the first time, was to add a low-resolution image in order to be able to reconstruct. They used a low-resolution image plus diffraction data in order to be able to reconstruct a high-resolution image. Now, we... back in 2003, we introduced this method that tries to find the sparsest support that will accommodate the diffraction data. So you start trying to apply phase-retrieval method with this a very large support that defines the boundary of the object, and iteratively shrink this support until you find the smallest one that still fits the experimental data. And somehow this happened back in 2003. We didn't know much about sparse modeling, but we found that this actually gave the solution to the problem. We didn't have a very good explanation except for the fact that it seemed to work. And we did some more demonstrations with also Henry Chapman and Anton Bartsch, where we basically push this technique to three dimensions and a fairly large size data. However, the problem is that phase retrieval in this way, the single particle diffraction, doesn't always work. The support determination algorithm is not entirely robust, even with simulation, and if you know the exact reconstruction, even when with perfect simulated data, no noise whatsoever, the reconstruction is not guaranteed. This is an example, a plot of many rounds of iterative reconstructions on perfect data, no noise. And you see the noise, the convergence, sometimes it converges nicely, but many times it doesn't. And depending on the object, you don't really know if this is ever going to jump down the solution. And the fact that there are a number of heuristic algorithms to solve the phase material problem, and this is a good indication of the fact that none of them is perfect. If one of them was perfect, everyone would just use the same. So there are all these heuristic methods that we don't really. The most popular method is called hybrid input-output, the one, but as I've shown here, it doesn't always converge. And so what we can do is use, I still have a few menu. So a couple.
Just 15.
What?
I've got to be down for 15. Start at 12:07. 15 more minutes.
Okay, so we have we have more and more X-rays, we have faster and faster detectors. Just recently we got a detector that is about 100 times faster than it used to be a couple of years ago. And so with a lot of X-rays and a lot of detectors, you can do more or less two things. One is more of the same. You can study more samples, more theory, and then explore and navigate through these things. Or just, you do reduction. So you basically use multi-frame data and turn a lot of frames into a better picture, high resolution, high contrast, or larger volume. And there are two examples. That one is psychography, which I will describe now, and the other is nanocrystallography and single molecule imaging that Anton Parti will probably describe. So I will skip that. So let me tell you about tachography. So in tachography, it's somewhat similar to diffractive, single particle diffractive imaging. So you have an X-ray beam. Now it's coming from the top, hits the sample, and you collect the diffraction pattern. Now the difference is that you actually combine diffraction with scanning. Now you scan through the sample and collect a stack of diffraction patterns. Now the fact that all these, this is a probe illuminating the sample, collect the diffraction pattern, probe illuminating another part of the sample, collect the diffraction pattern, and so on. Now, but because all these illumination functions are overlapping with each other, somehow the reconstruction problem becomes more robust. It always, when you apply an optimization method, it actually always converges, even though there's not real proof of this behavior. This is a technique that has been developed over the years, but only recently, thanks to past detectors, has become widely adopted. And so what you record is the diffraction data, which is the Fourier transform of the unknown object translated by some amount multiplied by the probe. So just a description of what happens. You have this probe illuminating an unknown object. You take the unknown object, which is a two-dimensional function. You stretch it into a one-dimensional vector. This is the unknown. You can describe all this in terms of matrix operations. The probe multiplied by the object extracts a little frame. Is this operation, this matrix operation, which is a sparse matrix. Then each one is fully transformed and taking the magnitude, this gives the stack of diffraction data. And typical reconstruction, you introduce an intermediate variable that represents the frame, the object illuminated by the function, and you divide the problem in two. Basically, one is that each frame has to fully transform amplitude, has to satisfy the measured amplitude, and the fact that each frame has to come from the same object. And by solving this problem using, again, similar nonlinear projection, as the single particle diffractive imaging, you just introduce two different types, two projections, one that allows you to fit the data, the other is that constrains the object to come, the, each frame to come from the same object. It actually converges in a very robust way. This is an example of an experiment we did recently. All the synchrotrons in the world are developing a typography because you just take a scanning microscope, you put a detector in the back, solve the phase 3 problem, you get a picture at much higher resolution. This was one of the first tests that we did with a new detector, and I'm sure we'll do better in the future. Now, just this two-dimensional problem is, as I described, is not terribly complicated. It's nonlinear, but it seems to converge. But now, if we really want to do three-dimensional super-resolution scanning diffractive imaging, you have to combine the spatial trio problem plus tomography, blind the convolution of the probe, because the probe, illuminating probe, is actually not known perfectly. Phase retrieval, multiple scattering, and figure out if there are vibrations on the sample. So now, let me finish. I hope I was able, I don't know, it was maybe a lot, but I hope I was able to give you an overview of the experiments in photon science. They are very diverse. There are a very large community of people doing all sorts of things, developing optimization methods in their own field. Maybe they don't talk to each other even. Sometimes it works like that. Then the other message I want to give is the fact that now we have this new fast detectors and brighter sources that give a higher frame rate that enable to achieve higher resolution of signal to noise. But putting all these frames together adds significant complication that needs to be added, done carefully. And there is not many people working on doing this, putting lots of data together, at least in photon science, in synchrotron source. And then sparse modeling, I look forward to the talk, future talk. Sparse modeling is a powerful method we already tested that allows to extract better images out of data. And then, in my opinion, phase 3 is still an open issue. If you can solve phase 3 problem in a more wide setting than what you currently can, it's always a good thing, and it's probably going to lead to more discoveries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for some questions, if there are some questions.
This might be a naive question, but I didn't quite understand that when you're reconstructing the image, surely there must be some smoothing or regularization imposed, and I didn't understand where that regularization was coming in. Is it in the, you have these various iterative algorithms. Is it basically through the number of iterative steps that you carry out, or? I'm wondering, when you reconstruct some, I don't know, protein molecule looks like, surely you have to have some sort of regularization or smoothing. Is that not correct? And I didn't quite see mathematically how that regularization was being imposed.
Regularization, there's not really a regularization. So the data is collected in Fourier space, and we know that the object is, so for example, depending on what constraints you have, if you know that the object is finite, defined in a support here, for example, and that's kind of self-regularizing in a way of the data.
Maybe we can discuss offline.
Other questions out there? I as a statistician, I am unable to resist asking you, but I didn't see error analysis. I didn't see sort of uncertainty.
Well, if you look at synchrotron papers, there is very little, I'm amazed that there are not many error bars.
Okay. So,
if you have a picture like. Well, certainly, one, if you don't have enough noise signal, the picture is going to look bad. And very often in synchrotron radiation, people just take a data like that and compare with the model to see. Two kind of look alike. This is not me. It's Alessandro Lanzara from UC Berkeley.
Can you explain this diagram a little more? What the lines are and what the...
This was just to show you that experimentally you can get almost the same thing as a model. And this is much faster than doing the model. So it's more for validating the model than the model validating the experiment. So here is the electronic band structure, E versus momentum. So this is the Fermi energy. This the curvature here, for example, tells you the effective mass of the particles in the... I just wanted to show that synchrotron radiation gives you electronic structures almost that you can compare with the model. I didn't want to delve into this because
no. Japan will go to the plot where he showed how HIO is converging, so that is a good example of statistics, actually, because... So typically how we do it, we start with random phases, and then we run this algorithm, so this iterative algorithms, and then you get... then you get just a set of solutions, and here is our trouble, where our trouble is coming, because they're all very close to each other, but they're not identical, really. And then what we do, usually we take 5 or 10 the best solutions, average them, and say, here is our result. And so here it's what you say about this smoothing progress. Here it comes, at that point, probably it comes. To say the truth, we are not satisfied with this procedure, really, and probably more of these Bayesian methods has to be used in order to sort out between the solutions, because each of them is kind of a model that we obtain. Though in kind of straightforward way, we don't use any model initially, but we get, after iterative reconstruction, we get this model. So on the final step, we should go with the Bayesian approach, probably, and to finalize and to find which one is the best one.
I should say there's not, okay, there is a procedure to, but it's not, there's not a consensus really on how to do this among the quantum scientists.
Any further questions? If not, I...
So I don't need to see it. Ron, I really enjoyed your talk, and you, I completely agree with your assessment of problems with the techniques you described. But to be fair, there were two papers in Science last week talking about getting confidence levels for crystallography, and those can be directly translated over to nanocrystallography. So at least there is hope for the future that some of these techniques might be imported also into these single particles.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I hope you will join me in thanking our speaker once again.
Yes, just to say that we start up after lunch today at 1:45, so that's in just under an hour's time. 1:45 for the start-up. The easiest place to get lunch is in the cafeteria, which is just across about 100 yards away. Just follow other people who know the way.
Oh, I don't know.
Mine has like a switch over there.
Yeah, I
I have not. How do we got like
It should be pretty quick. You're around it.
Well, I mean, I'm
showing.
I imagine communication
that I was
communication.
And I don't know how much this is thinking about how parameters around
This conference will now be disconnected. Goodbye.